Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Glad you could join us again for our podcast this week. Each week, we interview leaders, and they share lessons learned in their career. And this week, we're happy to have with us Dr. John Harrell. John is a leader in the area of life sciences. He's led organizations, both large and small, and he has a background as with a PhD in biochemistry and was a Fulbright scholar at Harvard Medical School. John has some great stories to tell about how he's led in crisis situations, and he's going to share other lessons that he's learned in his career. Looking forward to our conversation with John. And John, it's you're sitting in Indiana, and you're getting sounds like you're getting snow like what we've experienced in the last few days in April, which is kind of crazy. But so anyway, we've talked for a number of years. I was trying to think when we first were introduced, but it's been some time ago. First off, can you give us just a little bit of an overview of your career and a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure, Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you and your listeners today. It's cold here, which is very unusual, but we'll get through it. That's the least of our problems right now.
Right.
So, yeah, as you can gather, I'm originally an Australian. Well, actually, still am Australian, but became an American citizen along the way. So I did all of my education, if you like, in a formal sense. Hopefully, my education is never. I'm still learning, but formally I did all my education in Melbourne University, and I did a PhD there. I came out of a one-room schoolhouse in rural Australia, that was the first culture shock I got. The second culture shock I got was when I then did a Fulbright fellowship at Harvard Medical School. Wow. In Mass General, sure. and that was my second shock to the system, which I actually enjoyed a lot. And so that was sort of set a pretty good foundation for me. I think the work I did in Melbourne with Sid Leach, who's one of the key protein chemists. He worked with Shiraga and Amundsen, both Nobel Prize winners. And so I had a good foundations. And then I started to think about what I was going to do for a career. And I saw some really, at the time, it was in the late 70s. I saw some really smart people having struggle getting grant money, and even in Sid's lab, who was world renowned, he struggled to keep the lights on sometimes. So I thought that wasn't the life I wanted.
Sure.
And so I decided to go into industry and joined what was then the Commonwealth Serum Laboratories, which was part of the Australian government. Today it's CSL Inc. And it's the largest plasma processor in the world, and its revenues are in the multiple billions. I remember when they hit $1 million a month. So it's been a long journey. Yeah. So that was where I moved into industry and did a lot of work with some things as wildly disparate as vaccines and looking at things like penicillin development and production, insulin. Things which today are all made in India or China, but in those days we were all self-sufficient.
Sure.
So from there, though, I sort of got itchy feet after I'd been in Boston. I went back to Australia for a couple of years. CSL had helped me while I'd been in Boston, and so I had some obligations with them. So then I went back, and I got itchy feet, and so I decided I would pursue this commercial career, which I have done. And along the way, I really decided that I liked science a lot, and I had some talent in that. People could argue how much, but there was some there. And I enjoyed the commercial elements. So I thought, well, why don't I position myself in the middle? Because there was a lot of science going on, and there was a lot of need. And so I thought, well, maybe I can be the one to facilitate the movement of science into the commercial sphere. And these were back in the days when Genentech and Biogen were just kicking off. Mm. And when I was working as a Fulbright Fellow at Mass General, the person that I was working with, a guy called Vince Zarowski. And Vince had developed quite a skill at developing hybridomas and monoclonal antibodies. So he taught me a lot. And then he went on and he became the vice president of R&D for a company called Hybridomas Inc. That was just as I was finishing up in Boston. And that company, and he joined them, went down to Philadelphia, and that became CentiCorp. Mm. And, of course, CentiCorp was sold for about $3 or $4 billion to J&J eventually. But I was in fact, I then joined him with the team when we had one. We were in a single room with all of the founders and everybody just working on getting this company off the ground, which was incredibly exciting. But then, of course, I ran into visa issues, had to go back to Australia. So, but again, it sort of confirmed everything I was thinking about, of, you know, the excitement of being able to take science from the lab into the commercial sphere. So along the way, I've done that. I've done that in multiple countries. Australians love to travel. So my first stop was in Canada, where we had three children. Mm. So I have three Canadian children as well. then we went to England, and then Beringer Mannheim called calling and asked me to come to Indianapolis. So that's where we put roots down, in Indianapolis, and I've been moved around, joining several different companies around the country. At each stage, I've moved along mainly through just the curiosity I've got, and that I always get interested in things. And if things don't, you know, I get to a point where there's a plateau, I say, okay, time to do something different. And so I go on. For example, I went to, from Beringer, I went to Genzyme. From Genzyme, I came back to Indianapolis. We started a company with some friends here. We grew that for 4 years. Then I moved back to Boston. Then I went to North Carolina. It's always little things. Then I came back to Indianapolis. So finally, then I moved to California with Quest Diagnostics and had a great experience there for seven years. Then for a variety, that was living in California. Decided at that point there had been some big changes in the company. Left, went to Korea for a year. And the reason I did that was I'd become very enamored with molecular diagnostics. When I was with Quest, I ran a esoteric infectious disease business for them. We had a reference lab, product business, clinical trials. And it was a pretty big, about 700-800 people, which was good. And so I became very interested in molecular diagnostics. And this company in Korea really attracted me. It was called C-Gene, still is. It's now one of the leading molecular companies that's involved with the coronavirus testing. Mm. I think they sell it to 45 countries. They've done a hell of a job in Korea. But I got involved because I really enjoyed new technology, and their technology was around multiplexing. So again, my natural curiosity took me there. And then finally, you know, my wife had some health issues, so had to come back to Indiana after a year, which I really enjoyed living in Seoul, Korea. It's a fabulous place. If you like Korean food, it's terrific. Anyway, I came back and I was about to retire, and a company here called PTS Diagnostics asked me would I be interested in running their international business. My wife's health stabilized pretty well. She had a hearing problem. She's got a cochlear implant now. Interestingly enough, an Australian company, Cochlear. And so I came back. She went back to teaching at the Indiana University Dental School. And I was looking around for something to do and thinking retirement's not going to be much fun. And PTS came along and asked me to run their international business. So I did that, started a company in India for them. I spent a lot of time in India, became president of Asia-Pacific business, the Asia-Pacific business for them. So that included China and India. Spent a lot of time in both countries, and also let me get to Australia. Along the way, I took on some company directorships, became the chairman of a publicly listed company in Australia, took it through some crisis management issues. Left there, PTS was bought by a Chinese company. I decided time to retire for good. I took a change of control out of my contract, which was quite lucrative. And they immediately turned around and said, would you come back as a consultant and continue what you're doing? So I said, well, that sounds like a deal. So I did. And I finished that in December of 2018. And again, just settling into retirement. And JanaCare came and asked, could I give them support? I'd run into them in India. They're actually headquartered in Boston, but it's a startup out of Boston in India with some really smart people from MIT, Harvard Business School. Again, pushing me to learn new stuff. And so I advise them, and they've given me a fancy title. And so I work with them, and we're doing some interesting things. Again, doing some of the things that I along the way, I decided was the future diagnostics, which is moving it out into the, not only into point of care, but using things like tablets and mobile phones. PTS, I'd got involved a little bit with a company out of Taiwan that was doing that. It didn't go anywhere, but it was pretty exciting. And so when JanaCare came, I was really excited to see that they have a platform to do that. And so that's what we've been working on. And I've been able to give them not so much technical advice, more around the business side and taking things into the marketplace.
Right. Well, it sounds like a very interesting career. And I think when we first met, you were president at Quest Diagnostics. Mm-hmm. And so you've had just a broad range of experience, both international as well as here in the U.S. And tell us a little bit about, you know, just kind of with the present state, with what we're dealing with in the country, what impact do you think this will have on healthcare, and how that we, I know a lot of the telehealth companies have expanded and grown during this time, and just some of the trends that you're seeing as far as for the future for helping patients.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think that the coronavirus has done is really shine a light on some of the deficiencies we've got in the healthcare system. Clearly, it's a big issue. One of the lessons I hope that we learn when we get through this will be to, you know, how can we improve and get better at delivering healthcare. Mm-hmm. And you're right, telemedicine is becoming, people are becoming more used to it. I think maybe it was always there, but people needed some impetus, a desire or a requirement to use it. Now we have that, obviously.
Sure.
So I think that's going to grow. I think, you know, but just generally, I mean, people working from home, I think what you're going to see is people are going to say, companies are going to start saying, well, hang on, why are we spending all this money on this expensive buildings and real estate where, you know, we can be just as productive, hopefully, you know, from home. So I think there'll be some assessment of that. Obviously, mm-hmm. That won't happen across the board, but I think companies may get more comfortable in allowing people to work from home now, because there always has been somewhat of a barrier to people thinking that people wouldn't be quite as productive if they weren't. But also, of course, people need to have the interaction, and we do what we're doing now. Of course, we can have now Zoom meetings and other types of video interaction, so people don't feel quite as isolated. But I think that's going to become a bigger part of the way we do business. Mm-hmm. And that's going to have a big impact in our the way we deliver healthcare. And I think that some innovative companies are out there, have been out there, and I think they're accelerated some of the things that are going into the market. You know, remote medicine has always been a mixture of not doing anything and some telemedicine. But I think we're going to see a lot more of it. And I know, you know, my son's involved in he's a physician, mm-hmm. involved with a Native American medical hospital. And they're delivering more of their care now, in primary care at least, via that medium, telemedicine. And then they, of course, if things deteriorate, they can fly them in or fly a physician. Or the other issue I think we're going to see more is nurse practitioners and mm-hmm. and physician's assistants are going to become a more stable part of, or a more integral part, should I say, of our healthcare delivery system.
Sure. This is a crisis for companies that they're kind of having to manage through, and some of our audience are there new leaders, or are they kind of moving into new leadership roles? Give us a little bit of your background of managing through a crisis. Nobody's experienced one like this, but everybody who's been a leader for any length of time has had some crisis that they've had to manage. Give us some stories around that of how that you've done that in your career.
Yeah, you and I off before we started this, we talked a little bit about this, but back when I was first come to the U.S. with a big multinational German company, I was involved with the R&D operation, and in fact was not quite running all of it, but most of it. And we had about 400 or 500 people, about 450 people in R&D, and we were developing blood glucose systems and a product that had been put on the market in response to a competitor's product. So the whole thing had been accelerated, started to be seen as being problematic, and they finished up recalling it. And as at the time I was in the blood glucose seat, if you like, they asked me to put it back on the market. And no pressure, we're losing we lost about 27% of the market share we had, each percent about $9 million. So the company was hemorrhaging money. At the same time, competitors were catching up. So, we went into crisis mode. I had seen this coming to some extent. And I didn't expect them to be a recall, to be honest with you. I expected it to be a second generation product, and had a group working on solving some of the issues that we'd identified internally. And so we had most of the product improvement at a stage where we had to put it through validation and verification. But there was a couple of things, and it turned out to be the controls we didn't have. And so that was the rate limiting step. And, I think, as I mentioned to you off before we started here, one of the books that really influenced me at that time was a book that came out in 91 called Developing Products in Half the Time. And so that I'd been sort of following some of those principles. So we really ramped that up, and I followed some of the principles in that book. And so we really went into a mode of not only did we do things in duplicate, in the case of where we had a critical element, which was development of control solutions, we actually went into a triplicate mode, and I had three different teams, two outside the company and one inside the company working on a solution. And I basically said to them, I put some incentives in place and got permission to offer a financial bonus to the group that won. And the group that won was actually an external group, which was interesting. So, but, when we had to come down, there was a lot of nervousness about this because we'd already had one stumble. And so the validation and verification was, really, we had to do this in very, 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 very carefully. And it started to become very monotonous, but also the teams were starting to feel the stress. So we decided to do some things. We had to test some certain conditions. So I sent a whole team up to Leadville, Colorado, which turns out to be one of the highest places in the U.S. with some sort of medical clinic. We set them up there for a week. And so they did testing at altitude, I think it's about 11,000 feet. Don't quote me on the height. And then I sent a group down to the Caribbean. You can imagine which was the most popular of those two. At that point, we decided, it was probably too expensive, and we lost track of some people down in the Caribbean. So we took some cold rooms, we turned them into warm rooms. I put some palm trees in there, turned on Jimmy Buffett, and so we turned it into a tropical testing center. And so they're the sort of things we did, and we got the product back on the market within 12 months. And so, it was a pressure cooker type environment with a lot of things in parallel. And the most important thing was to always keep track of the fact that, the company, was really hurting, and we just needed to get this on the market. But on the other hand, we also needed to make sure that this thing didn't bounce back at us. And so So those were the things, and I say I learned this a lot of this out of this book that I had taken to heart at the back a year or two before that.
Great, that's a great story. So, as you're thinking about kind of what we're going through, and I know you've got a team that you manage currently, and that they're spread out in different locations. Any advice that you can give? And again, the story you just told, you had some teams that were spread out in different locations, how to, right. to manage effectively remotely?
Yeah, it's always a challenge. And I think these days, of course, that challenge is not quite as bad because we do have the video conferencing mm-hmm. and we have, you know, computers are more, you know, laptops are more ubiquitous. Back in those days, there were computers, but sure. laptops were cumbersome things to carry around. So we have more opportunity. And I mean, the most important thing is, like with any team, you know, the chemistry is important. The technical competence is important. But it's also, you really have to be have good communicators. And so the most important element that I've always found is the communication. And it's not just one way, it's two ways. So as a team leader, you really need to be very clear about what the objectives are. You need to be very clear about the resources that are available. And you need to build confidence that problems can be brought to the table without there being personal consequences. And that was one of the big things that we did during that crisis management. You know, look, you know, if you get behind, don't hide it. If you, you know, if your schedule gets behind or something goes wrong, you make a wrong decision, don't worry about it. Bring it to us. And if you bring it to us, we can do something about it. We can help you. If you don't, if you hide it, then there would be negative consequences because things will just continue to snowball. And in a remote situation, there's more opportunity for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And so the building of communication and confidence and of leadership and as in a leadership position, you need to give people the confidence that they can bring you problems and hopefully with solutions, but that you are seen as a resource to resolve issues. Sometimes those issues are, well, we need to bring another couple of guys onto the project, so you move. As leader, you can move things around. Maybe we need a few more dollars to get a consultant to come in and help us solve a problem. Those are the sort of things. Don't try and struggle with it yourself, thinking that that'll be seen as a weakness, your personal weakness. And so I think those types of elements of developing a team and leading a team are really really the difference between success and failure in my experience.
So what are some things that you've learned about hiring a team, and what are some of the qualities that you look for as you're evaluating people to add to your team?
Yeah, and I think anybody starting out needs to do this, and that is you really have to focus on the chemistry, the individual chemistry. Does the potential hire fit in with the chemistry of the people that are currently there? Sometimes we overlook what we might call quirks or issues. Because they have great technical skills.
Sure.
But if those technical skills can't be applied across the team, then they don't really add the value that you're looking for. And so the first thing is just to understand the dynamics of your team and then find people that fit within those dynamics. So that's the first thing. Second thing is obviously having the skill set that you want and be able to see how that fits with the objectives of what you're trying to achieve. Thirdly, communicate it. You know, somebody that sits there, stares at the floor and mumbles, but they're terrific at whatever they do, I would have an issue with that because I think, you know, you need people that can speak up when there are problems, speak up when there's something that's that needs to have some attention drawn to it. So, I mean, those people are individual contributors in my mind, and we have a lot of those that do a great job in the, you know, in science and technology, mm-hmm. but they don't fit well within the team structure. So that's an important element. So, and then people who have self-confidence and self-starters. So the one of the biggest mistakes that, particularly when you're starting out, you try to micromanage because you're young, you're enthusiastic, and you are technically pretty clear of what your abilities are. And you say, well, I can do that better than anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, but I used to say to my staff, this is your job. You know, if I have to do it, one of us is not needed, and it's probably not me. Don't overmanage. Don't get them to come to you to solve the problems, or unless there's an issue that they can't get around, they need a leadership decision. But don't try to do the job. So give people clear objectives, give them resources, make sure that they keep on track. You monitor, if you like, you get reports, you review with them. But there's always a tendency to try and step in. Mm-hmm. The only time you step in is when they, because of the relationship you've built, that they come when you've got an irretractable problem. They've tried to solve it. They can't get it. They know that they need more people and need more money. They need somebody, another skill set they don't have, and they try to hide it. But if you've got built the relationship that confidence that they will get support and not being seen as in a negative sense, they'll bring them to you, and it's, you work together as a team. You know, I always say to people, you know, don't bring me problems, bring me solutions. And I got a problem here. Well, what's your solution? Well, I need more people. I need more people. I need a consultant. I need another piece of equipment. Okay. As the lead team leader, then I've got to solve that problem for them. But they're the sort of problems that a leader should be looking at.
That's good. I ask this of every leader that comes on the podcast. If you were able to go back, knowing what you know now, to a 22-year-old John, what advice would you give yourself?
I think a couple of things. I think if you look at the management manuals and when people talk about management, they always talk about management of teams, management down. You have to learn to manage up. And so I think that's something that people sometimes neglect. I certainly did. And you don't build the relationships up the organization because you're too focused on achieving your goal by looking and looking down into the organization. So that's definitely one. I think the other thing is that, you know, probably earlier I should have learned how to build teams and the importance of chemistry. Mm-hmm. All of the things that I talk about are the things that I've learned by hard examples where I've made mistakes. And so that's important. And then, you know, the other thing that's really important, and I was just listening to, actually just finished a book by Tom Stavridis, a big four-star admiral, who just came out with a very interesting book. And, he talks about balance. And again, he chastised himself because he didn't create the balance in his career versus personal life. And I can probably say that. And so I was warned along the way, but I didn't listen. Now, I have the advantage of having a wonderfully supportive wife. And so the balance didn't have an impact so much, but the lack of balance. But, you know, being too caught up in your career, being too caught up in the latest project can be, you lose track. And I was lucky that it didn't have, I've got terrific kids and they're all very accomplished and my wife's still around, which is good, after nearly getting close to 50 years. But the balance is important. You know, learn to pick up career, pick up some hobbies, focus on family, and that gives you, you know, stress relief for when you go back into the fray, you're feeling fresh again.
Sure. Speaking of kind of outside of work, you mentioned some hobbies. What are some things that you do to kind of recharge? And now it's hard because everybody's stuck at home, but when things are normal.
Yeah, well, you know, my interests wax and wane. Like, you know, I'd say I'm a very curious person. And so, you know, I've done woodworking and I enjoy that a lot. In fact, I'm not very good at it, but, you know, working with my hands is a lot of fun. I like to sail when I get a chance. Indianapolis is not known for its coastline. Right. It does have a coastline up on the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan, but that's a long way off from where I live. You know, my children live all over the world, so or over the country, so I get a chance to travel. I love to travel, and like times in Asia particularly. So we go there on any time we get a chance, and we visit family, and then my son lives in Alaska, so one of them lives in Alaska, so we like to fish and hike and things like that. Sure. So, you know, they're good physical things which help to recharge the batteries a little bit, because you're particularly in my stage of my career, it's all mostly mental. So you're thinking all the time, you're going through a lot of options and reading documents that need thought and analysis, and these things really, the physical things, bring you back and recharge you.
Right. You mentioned a couple books, that one that you just read, and then one that was used earlier in your career. Any others that you think a leader should definitely pick up and read?
Oh, well, there are lots of terrific leadership and management books out there, but, you know, a couple that really impacted me, I mentioned the Developing Products in Half the Time, which was in 1991, I believe, first came out. But the one that really set me off was In Search of Excellence, and you probably know this, Peters and Waterman. It's sort of an unbelievable classic. Came out in 81, and I was just sort of, I just got back from my time in Boston, back in Australia, and so I started reading this, and it just struck me, you know, it was such a revelation that going into all these, you know, leading companies and understanding what they do better and why they're at the top of their game, that it was just amazing. And there was like 8 principles, I forget them all now, but they were it just, it told me that, you know, if I'm going to get into this business and move into the commercial world, and rather than developing my career down the scientific pathway, that I would, these are the sort of principles that I'd like to follow. And, you know, be innovative, call to action, don't lose sight of your customer. And, you know, and that's the same as developing products half the time. You know, the customer is important, and how you can, you know, get to the customer and do it and put your company into a competitive position. And then the other books that I really enjoy are biographies. This one of, you know, for some reason, military guys really attract me. And my wife, my daughter's in the Navy, so maybe some of it.
Sure.
But, you know, the book by Admiral Bill McRaven, the head of SEALs, is a fascinating book from a personal development and career, following his career. And again, with this book by Admiral Stavridis, he covers, including McRaven, but he covers 10 admirals and, you know, puts it in perspective of today. And it talks about a lot of the things that, you know, a good leader needs to do, a good leader, how a good leader should act, how a good leader should perform, and what character traits should they have. And it goes right back into, you know, the Athenian type, back to Athens, and then brings himself all the way through and talks about the pros and the cons of the characters of the different famous people. So that's a terrific book to read, from just a learning about leading people and the character traits, the pros and the cons.
Sure.
And how people overcome negative character traits.
Is there any parting advice that you'd give somebody?
I think the most important thing is never to stop learning. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we all get on a track and get tied up in the specifics of your job, and you say, well, I'm learning new things, but you should be always reaching out, because that's how you get some perspective. Mm-hmm. That's how you see what's coming. You know, the steam train that's coming that you're driving has got an electric train coming at you in the other direction. You need to see it. I think that would be a couple of the most important elements. I did actually take a couple of a couple of notes on that when we were talking. The other thing is, always think about how do you do your job better. How can you be innovative? You know, be curious, innovate, and keep learning. And I think those are the things which I talk to my own children about. You know, they keep they shouldn't get stale in their business because the world's moving, the world's changing, and you need to keep up with it. And it's hard these days, particularly. But on the other hand, with all the technology we have these days, it's technically, well, there's more to learn and more to keep up with. There's more ways to help you do that. For example, I'm talking to you from my iPad, which is an amazing thing because when I first went to Boston, I saw the first electronic calculator.
Sure.
So, you know, it's I've seen technology change. So the technology, you know, somebody is listening and they're just starting their career now. When they're at my stage in their career, that the world's going to be a lot different. The technology is going to be a lot different. And hopefully they will be a lot different and will be able to be just as competitive today then as they are today.
Great. Well, thanks, John. I always enjoy talking to you. You're someone who continues to grow and develop even at your stage of your career. I love to talk to people that that have that mindset. You can never stop learning and growing. So appreciate your time and your insights.
It's been delightful. Look forward to our next discussion.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.